You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, November 19th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, as Israel's attacks on Gaza and Gaza's attacks on Israel continue, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, co-director of the Middle East Task Force, former Israeli peace negotiator Daniel Levy will be joining us from the UK. Give us a sense of what the prospects are for truth and why this violence, at least this round of violence over there, is happening. Also on the program today, the Republicans, still on their lip service to sanity tour. It's funny, folks. It's funny. And as Twinkies sail into the night, because they were objects of leveraged buyout artists, who all seem to have done very well for themselves. Not so much for the near 20,000 workers who will be laid off, but for themselves, not so bad. Walmart still scrambling, worried about this Black Friday, or now, I guess, what is it, Black Thursday now they're calling it? Black Thursday evening? Who knows? Black Friday Eve. Also on the program, Marco Rubio trying desperately to wedge between Crazyville and acceptable to Americaville. Fails, in my estimation. Joe Lieberman reminds everyone that everyone still hates him. Apparently he's still in the Congress. I didn't know that. Still in the Senate. This quick story before we get to Daniel Levy. Alan West demands a recount. A couple of weeks ago, refusing to admit defeat. And unfortunately for Alan West, the Republican congressman slash guy who would probably be in a straitjacket if he wasn't a congressman from St. Lucie County in Florida, or at least that's the area that they wanted the votes recounted. The results are in. He's now losing by a greater margin. Preliminary numbers released by around 2 p.m. on Sunday. Or I think it was Sunday or Saturday. By the St. Lucie, Sunday, by the St. Lucie County Board showed Murphy, his opponent, Patrick Murphy, with an even greater lead. Now over 13,000 votes. Murphy's lead now has increased to a 0.65%. West still has yet to concede. I don't know if he's conceded that he's lost the election or that he's completely clinically insane. But on either accord, Alan West still thinks he is the congressman from Florida. As of mid-January, I suspect he's going to be starting his own shadow government, providing congressional local services for his constituents. Good luck to you, sir. Good luck to you.
He's calling his opponent's campaign garbage when they asked him to finally concede this time around.
Right, of course. Of course he won't.
You know, like with Alan West, when we just are always saying so-and-so's crazy, this person's crazy, blah, blah, blah. But in his case, you might start to think, like, maybe we shouldn't say that because he might actually really be, like, crazy.
No, he's crazy.
Clinical.
Yeah. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Daniel Levy. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For Majority Report listeners, you can get a free Audible book download right now. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Majority Report. That's audiblepodcast.com/Majority Report. Pick up David Graeber's book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, as a free audiobook at audiblepodcast.com/Majority Report. Do it now. It's free. We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone is Daniel Levy. He is the Director of Middle East European Council for Foreign Relations and a Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. Daniel, can you hear us?
I can hear you, Sam. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you. You're joining us from the UK. And apparently, phones work across the oceans now.
Amazing, right? Amazing. Yes. I thought we would do this by carrier pigeon.
Well, that's always an option here for us, but rather prefer this. So, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. Let's start in this very narrow conflict that has taken place over the past couple of weeks, I guess. between Israel and Hamas and other forces in Gaza. What has precipitated these strikes on Gaza?
Look, there was an escalation. There's almost been a set of understanding, sometimes more formal, sometimes less formal. It's almost like a tariff bar. If Israel does X, it's expected that the groups in Gaza will respond by doing Y, and vice versa, if they initiate and do X. It's been largely kept in a box the last 4 years, albeit these haven't been good years. There have been 271 Palestinians killed and 3 Israelis killed since the last major operation. There was a mini escalation. A Palestinian civilian was killed. There was rocket fire. Another Palestinian killed, more extensive rocket fire. And then it seemed to be dying down. We seemed to be put it back in the box. There were a set of understandings. And then the Israeli prime minister decided to launch a larger offensive with the assassination of this military leader of Hamas, this Jabari, and with a series of air raids, and the expected response came with the rockets. Why now? I think there's a variety of factors, some of them to do with Hamas and their calculations, but I don't think Hamas was planning for it to go this far. So I think the immediate decision to take this to a whole new level was taken by the Israeli prime minister. He's the one who decided to escalate this to a new level. And I think that has to do with both politics, the Israeli election, and to do with the situation in the region, where I think he wanted to lay down a marker and make the statement that even in the new regional circumstances post-Arab Spring, Israel would still have a free hand to do things like this.
Okay, and now what of the reports from Gershon Baskin, who apparently was engaged in some type of was some type of liaison between the Israelis and Hamas in terms of attempting to negotiate some type of truce. He's written a piece, I think one was in the Daily Beast. I think he's had a couple of other op-eds suggesting that Jabrim at the time was Jabari, I should say, was contemplating a new truce agreement that had been delivered, I guess, by parties in Cairo. What of that?
Well, I mean, there are constant channels of communication. I know people who just kind of look at the immediate surface news may think, oh, well, obviously the only way Israel and Hamas communicate with each other is in violent ways. But there are ongoing channels of dialogue and communication, mostly indirect, between Israeli officialdom and Hamas officialdom. There have been a series of understandings over the last years. Sometimes those have been more formal, sometimes more informal. And I think this was another episode in that. There was a significant lull in the fighting before the Israeli assassination and the bombing missions. So I don't think Israel and Hamas were about to sign some great breakthrough, far-reaching set of understandings. I don't think that's on the table. I don't think that's where either party is at right now. Certainly not the Israelis on the eve of an election, and almost certainly not under the Netanyahu premiership. But were we going back to the more limited but effective ceasefire arrangements reached in the past? I think that part of the Baskin claim is very credible, and that's very likely where we were on the eve of this Netanyahu escalation.
Baskin also characterizes Jabari as at least functioning to in that sort of I don't want to call it theater, obviously, because it has much more sort of serious implications, but this notion of where there were certain parameters in which retaliation on both sides would take place, that Jabari was able to clamp down on the more radical elements within Gaza, the Salafists and the Islamic Jihad. Is that characterization accurate? And if so, what happens now? Is there forces in Hamas that have the ability to tamp down those more radical factions?
Look, this is one of the problems that we face right now. If there's going to be a serious effort at some kind of truce, some kind of cessation of hostilities, which is that Jabari was, by all accounts, an important actor in achieving these kinds of de-escalations in the past, because, as you just said, Sam, he was able to work with those different factions. So one of the byproducts of Israel deciding that this was the time to take out a particular guy with an extrajudicial assassination means that you don't have him there to play that role. Is it possible that others could step in and fill that role? It's certainly possible, and it's probably even likely, but it just makes things more complicated. But the two things I think that's important to understand in this aspect of it is that, first of all, Palestinians in Gaza are pissed. They are angry. They have been living under kind of blockade conditions that have only been slightly eased for several years. Israel controls the airspace. Israel controls their sea passages, their territorial waters. The closure imposed on the Egyptian side of the border has only eased a little since the change of regime in Egypt. And, of course, Israel still maintains a regime of allowing in only a agreed list of items and not allowing real reconstruction to take place. And there's a tunnel economy. So the alternative to Hamas in Gaza is not teddy bears. It's more likely to be people who want to take a more active military approach to trying to address the situation they are in. I'm not saying that justifies rockets against innocent civilians. That's a violation of international law. But that's the dynamic in Gaza. So you need to be able to bring those people along with you if you're going to maintain a ceasefire. The other important point to understand about Hamas is that it's not atypical to have a political movement in a liberation struggle that also has a military wing. You had it with Sinn Féin and the IRA. You had it with the ANC in South Africa, Umkhonto weSizwe, the military wing of the ANC. And you have it with the Hamas movement and their military wing. The advantage of disciplined political movements with military wings is that you can cut political deals with them, because they are not in the business of violence for violence's sake. They are in the business of seeing violence as one method through which they try to advance their struggle. It's difficult for them to rein in the others, but of course Hamas is a political address.
So Daniel, I mean, with this understanding, you know, and with the understanding that as you deprive people of amenities in Gaza, obviously it radicalizes the population. Also, from a practical standpoint, like you say, there's a tunnel economy. So you're building the infrastructure essentially to bring more weapons in there, and you refer to the Jabari killing assassination as the byproduct being that you have now sort of, at least for the time being, short-circuited that relationship between this political entity and its military wing, which can be negotiated with because it has a political wing, as opposed to some of these more radical groups. What is the strategic what are the strategic goals here? I mean, it seems to me that there is absolutely no outline or vision for how this could in any way ever bring peace. I mean, I'm not saying that there is a legitimate use of force to bring about peace, but at least sometimes we hear that articulated. It doesn't even seem to be lip service to that.
Look, I agree with you, Sam, and search me for the strategic thinking behind this. I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that if you had Prime Minister Netanyahu on the show, he wouldn't give a very convincing answer to what is the strategic goal here. If I were to try, I would say the following. One of the things that Netanyahu, I think, wants to achieve is to be able to say that in the new environment in the Middle East, Israel will still act aggressively, assertively, and initiate military operations at a time and in a way of its choosing. And that has been the way that Israel has dealt with living in that neighborhood, to make sure that people know that Israel can go crazy, so to speak. Israel will not flinch from using the fact that it has, in no small measure thanks to the United States, a significant military edge over all of its neighbors put together. How do you get from there to ever living in peace in the Middle East when you are vastly outnumbered by Muslims and Arabs surrounding you, by people who see as co-religionists and as brothers and sisters of a similar ethnicity, the Palestinians? How does that offer your people, your country, any future other than living by the sword in perpetuity? How is that a good strategy for the Jewish people? That's where it all falls short. If you want to send if you have a broader approach that says, look, we got to live in this neighborhood, but sometimes we got to get tough. But that's not what they're doing. The occupation continues. There is no effort to come to terms with the 20% of Israelis who are Palestinians and to offer them genuine partnership in an Israeli democracy. There's no effort to come to terms with the Palestinians under Israeli occupation. There's no effort to come to terms with those who were made refugees as a consequence of Israel's war of independence, many of whom live in Gaza itself. And by extension, there's no effort to come to terms with how is Israel going to build peaceful relations with democratic neighbors. When these were authoritarian states, they could pay lip service to the Palestinians, but essentially do nothing. Now the pressure is, and you see that already in the last 96 hours, the pressure is on more democratic, more accountable Arab leaders to do more. And that's why I would argue that this is very high stakes risks that Israel is taking if it doesn't fundamentally think about how to reposition itself in the neighborhood. But I don't see the strategic forethought here at all, Sam.
How does this play out in terms of, I mean, I'm curious, obviously, Egypt is implicated significantly in this, and I think that's what you're getting at to a certain extent. But I'm also curious, you know, it seems to me over the years that you and I have spoken that two things that I have noticed. One, the Israeli people seem to have even less of an appetite for some type of negotiated settlement. And two, that the United States has become a malignant factor in this dynamic. I mean, we saw the Bush administration pushing Israel in certain directions and not pushing back on Israel, specifically their incursion into Lebanon. It seems to me that the U.S. is completely sidelined now in some respects, and to the detriment, it's no longer providing the Israeli government with any type of leverage in which to push back against its own domestic populations, feeding its domestic politics. And there seems to be less inclination on those domestic politics to be fed any type of negotiation.
No, look, absolutely. First of all, if you are fed, and there's often talk of incitement on the Palestinian side, and sadly some of that is true. But on the Israeli side, if you are fed a narrative of what these people are about constantly, if you can imagine an America that never moved on from the post 9/11 scaremongering Iraq war neoconservative nonsense, but that just kept getting deeper and deeper entrenched. And if you can imagine that the folks who were behind that, if they were driving a consensual narrative, imagine where America would be. And now think of how long Israel has not had an effective alternative voice. It's not like in the States where it took a few years for the Democrats to find their footing, to be able to push back against the Iraq war, push back against at least some of the nonsense, and we're still not there yet, of the global war on terror and the neoconservatives. You haven't got that in Israel. And so what you have is a narrative becoming ever more deeply entrenched that is reflected in the leadership, and it's a symbiotic relationship between where the public is at and where the leadership is at. And sometimes societies go through very dark phases. And this gets at what you were talking about, Sam. And you're encouraged in your worst tendencies by the external actors. So Israelis feel vindicated because Netanyahu is able to turn around to them and say, you guys thought I had a problem with this guy Obama and we weren't on the same page? Look at what just happened. I basically poked him in the eye as often and as blatantly as I could throughout his election campaign. But the moment I went in and started an operation against the Palestinians, he stood with me. He phoned me the same night. We're on the same page. There's no clear daylight between us. So Israel has its very worst tendencies reinforced by, unfortunately, not just a Bush America, but also by the current president, who really should know better.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that it is a clear sign that he's worried that in the event that, I mean, I without it trying to divine what his real perspective is,
right,
that he wants to maintain some type of capacity to get through some domestic agenda, and he's just basically abdicating any role in getting involved in this conflict.
And look, there may be other things playing into this. I'm sure that he has people who are able to give wise counsel, who on this issue would say to him, well, Mr. President, if you show that you're supportive on day one, then it allows you to lean more on the Israeli prime minister on day five. And if you go easy with them on this issue, then maybe you can put some credit in the bank to come back and revisit the settlement issue or something like that, and listen to what sensible Israelis like the defense minister and the president say. It's a misunderstanding of where Israel is at. And Israelis, unfortunately, have grown very used to there being no cost or consequence for actions that in other cases would lead them to question their leaders' policies. And America is crucial to there being no cost or consequences, crucial to an Israel that believes it can continue down this path with impunity. And that is terribly irresponsible by the United States towards Israel, of course, also towards its own interests and its own relations in the Middle East, because people are not going to, Arab leaders who have to be more accountable to their publics are not going to be able to afford to act like Mubarak and to basically humiliate himself on this issue every time by going along with the American diktat, sometimes very enthusiastically. So people haven't changed disc yet in the United States. I hope that this has more to do with immediate post-election fiscal cliff congressional priorities for President Obama, and it's not just a fundamental misreading of the conflict, but I'd love to see more by way of reassurance on that.
Well, Daniel, I know that you have to run. Let me just one final question. To the extent that there is any type of outside pressure that can come that can begin to impact Israel's behavior and provide some type of backstop in some respects. Do you see any of what appears to me to see, you know, Brown University, for instance, is at least talking about divestment from companies, American companies that are doing business in the occupied territories in the West Bank. Do you see any hope that a movement like that, that comes from the sort of the United States people, can have any long-term impact?
I'm all in favor of people taking the power that they have as citizens, as consumers, as students, as investors, and saying we're going to take a stand. And I do not see how anyone who claims to support a democratic Israel that is not in permanent occupation, how anyone who supports a democratic Israel could take offense at the idea of not investing in companies that invest themselves in the occupation. I fear that the trajectory, how long it will take for those things to really have an impact, especially when there is such a forceful pushback by far too much of the mainstream Jewish establishment, who really should know better and should be acting more responsibly towards Israel. I fear that that means that those kinds of efforts will be behind the curve, and what will end up making a difference is developments on the ground. And if you're not moving political diplomatic solutions, you're going to see either violence, which no one wants, or you're going over time to see that the Arab and other regional actors will increasingly take a more assertive approach, whether that's in sanctioning, whether that's in diplomacy, or whether that's in military terms, because one of the outcomes of these past few days is rockets on Tel Aviv. How is that good?
Right.
How does that play out well? And it's that kind of short-sighted thinking which is very sad to behold, but it's leading in a very dangerous direction for Israel, and people who claim to care about Israel and then do everything to defend the status quo are going to really have to be in the dock as this thing continues to go south.
Daniel Levy, Director of Middle East Affairs for the European Council on Foreign Relations and Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, thanks so much for giving us your time today.
Thanks a lot, Sam. Take care.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Beep-boo. We will take a quick break and come back with a couple of stories before we go to the better half. Just a reminder now that becoming a member of the Majority Report is not only incredibly gratifying for you as a person, but it also keeps this show alive. Got a lot of plans for the new year, for 2013. We want to try and make them real, and we need your support to do so. So you can become a member today at majority.fm. There's other ways of supporting the show. We'll talk about that later, but let's take a quick break when we come back after a very brief musical interlude, and I'll touch upon a couple of these other stories. Yes, folks, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. One of the things that people really enjoy about this show is our capacity from going to from in-depth interviews, smart interviews with guys who are actors in some respects to a lot of this conflict and have been actors in the past. Daniel Levy served on the negotiating team during the Oslo negotiations. He was involved in drafting other measures that attempt to bring about peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. To our capacity to go to lowbrow things and be petty and crap on people that I don't like. Speaking of whom, I'm talking, of course, Joe Lieberman. For those of you who may not be aware, Joe Lieberman is still a senator. For those of you who don't watch Fox News Sunday programs and think about completely irrelevant guys who used to be a vice presidential nominee, and no, I'm not talking about Paul Ryan. That's right. There you go. Retiring Senator Joe Lieberman. What is his party again? Lieberman, Connecticut for Lieberman Party? Said on Fox News Sunday that there has been no talks of him working at the State Department, Defense Department, or CIA, and it's not what I'm planning for the next chapter of my life.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, in other late-breaking news, there's also no plans for Todd Akin to be chair, to head the Health and Human Services department in the Bush, in the Obama administration. He added that if he's offered a top role, you've got to give it serious consideration, but I'm not waiting by the phone. I don't expect a call. Really? I mean, think about how obvious this statement is. Just the idea, the fiction that Fox News must live in and the complete delusion that Joe Lieberman must live in if he doesn't laugh hysterically at the notion. He has been rejected by everyone except for apparently Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday. And he's going to go running into the arms of some big organization that lobbies on behalf of insurance companies, I'm sure. Whatever the most despicable and money-grubbing and self-promoting thing that Joe Lieberman could get into, that is where I anticipate you seeing him land. It'll be, if you could somehow combine, like Donald Trump in his Apprentice TV show, and everything that, what's that guy's, the former Indiana senator?
Evan Bayh.
Evan Bayh. If you could combine what these two guys have done with their lives, that would be Joe Lieberman.
There, so, like, totally crass, tasteless, and yet somehow also really boring.
Yes, indeed. Really crass, really tasteless, all about self-aggrandizement and shilling for corporate values, but also being just put you to sleep boring in about 20 seconds. That's what I predict next for Joe Lieberman. So, glad to see you go. I'll give you one of these. And meanwhile, on the Republican lip service to sanity tour, we see all sorts of Republicans scrambling around now to talk about how Mitt Romney was so bad for the party because he actually espoused Republican views on a national stage. And you really, really, it's inappropriate to do that, at least in mixed company. In other words, real human beings mixed with the Republicans. Rubio, interviewed by GQ, being asked the question, Marco Rubio, of course, the guy who thinks that he's going to be the next presidential nominee for the Republicans because he's equally deluded. Not inconceivable that he would be a VP pick, but I think it's going to take more than 4 years for the Republicans, the electoral base, to accept a non-white person. And even more so, I think it's harder for them to accept a non-white male. Like, you know, I think they go all in with a Latina because they might be able to say, well, she's just a woman anyway. She's never going to be in charge of anything.
right? That's their perspective. So he's asked in GQ. Remember now, he is on his lip service to sanity tour so that he's not excluded from contention. And he's feeling the heat because Bobby Jindal, who was, you'll recall, the first guy to come out and basically give, I think, a national Tea Party speech following President Obama's State of the Union address back in, I think it was 2009, right? It must have been. Was the first guy to give like a, what I would perceive a national Tea Party address. Bobby Jindal's out there going like, we can't be this crazy in public. And I don't have much time to say this because I've got to go to an exorcism that I've got planned. So Rubio is now seeing that he's got to come out and sound sane. So he's asked the question, how old do you think the earth is? And now I'm going to quote from Marco Rubio. I'm not a scientist, man. I can tell you what recorded history says. I can tell you what the Bible says. But I think that's a dispute amongst theologians. And I think it has nothing to do with the gross domestic product or economic growth of the United States. Let's just parse this sentence because it's insane and also nonsensical. It's actually two sentences, to be fair. I'm not a scientist. What he's saying here is, I'm not a scientist, but I'm also not going to listen to the scientists. In fact, I'm just going to say the word science and leave it at that. But then he goes, I can tell you what recorded history says. I can tell you what the Bible says. So in other words, how old the earth is maybe a function of how long humans have been here. But I think that's a dispute amongst theologians. And then he goes on to say it has nothing to do with the gross domestic product or economic growth of the United States. So in other words, he's saying like, I don't have the cojones to say that the earth is 9,000 years old, but I also don't have the cojones to say that it's more than 9,000 years old because I'm not a scientist, man. And I can't read or believe scientists, man. Unless he's saying I'm not a scientist, man, in which case he has a real problem with syntax. And then he goes on to say again, I'm not a scientist. I don't think I'm qualified to answer a question like that. Apparently he's not also qualified to read what scientists say.
Or even just search Google.
Yes, apparently, according to Matt, Google, they don't even link. Their first thing is not even a link to a scientist saying that. They present it in the same way they would present, like, if you were to write in, how old is the earth? Or what day is Christmas? Well, they just put it up there. They don't link you to some authority that's going to give you the date of Christmas. Just up there because it seems to be not in dispute with most sane people. At the end of the day, I think there are multiple theories out there on how the universe was created, not the question. And I think this is a country where people should have the opportunity to teach them all. Whether the earth was created in 7 days or seven actual eras, I don't even know what that's supposed to mean. That's the way he's covering his ass. I'm not sure we'll ever be able to answer that. It's one of the great mysteries. Like, how does a car work? Or how do you set the data on your VHS? That joke would have been funny 15 years ago. So there it is, the lip service to sanity tour. Don't think that's going to quite cut it. All right, folks. Speaking of Christmas, a lot of people apparently shop this time of year. I just argue with my kid and explain to her that we don't have a tree in our house because we're not Christian. But apparently a lot of people buy presents. Now, Hanukkah's coming up. If you haven't already gotten your Hanukkah gifts.
Don't Jewish people put up a tree and call it a Hanukkah bush?
I said that if we can't go to Michigan this year because her grandparents celebrate Christmas, then maybe we can get like a plant.
But I'm not going crazy. You have heard of a Hanukkah bush, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah. I mean,
not every Jewish person does it, but.
Right. No. And, you know, that's, I understand why she, you know, look, when I was a kid, we put up stockings just so that we weren't totally sort of blanked on Christmas Day. And we would go over to people's houses who are celebrating Christmas. But be that as it may, folks, the point is, if you buy crap through Amazon to celebrate any holiday or just to buy crap on Amazon and you are not buying it through the Majority Report link, you got to look yourself in the mirror and say, what is wrong with me? Because this is a completely sweat-free, cost-free way for you to continue to do what you're doing, but also make our jobs here a little bit easier. It will take you 5 minutes, not even, to set this up for yourself. You go to majority.fm/support the show, or just click through support the show. You click on the Amazon link. You bookmark it. That's Amazon for you. You will notice zero difference. If you're a Prime member, you still can just sign up for your Prime member. Once you're at that link, you will notice no difference. But we get a tiny kickback, and you know, it's not nothing. It's the easy way to do it. If you drink coffee and you like really good coffee and you want to be supportive of a great company in Madison, Wisconsin, that is a co-op owned by its employees, that is conscientious, fair trade, they make sure everybody involved in delivering that coffee, tea or chocolate to you is getting paid their worth, not being exploited. JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% discount. You can get the Majority FM blend. I get constant emails from people saying, the coffee's great. The coffee's great. It's really great. So those are ways you can support the show. And we'll put a link at majority.fm in the today's blog post, and we'll get an ad up there where you can take our survey. Whether you're a member or not, your survey, it'll take you 5 minutes to complete. Very easy. I think it's 15 questions. Very helpful to us. So as we are trying to figure out where the show is going to go forward, you know, we're planning to get a little bit more involved in some campaigns that are going on, like activist campaigns, maybe. We're, at least it's something we're contemplating. And we're looking around for perhaps a sort of a more stable sponsor who shares our values, who we can bring value to and they can bring value to us. If you have ideas, send us an email. So, and that is it. We will have live shows tomorrow and Wednesday. And then members will have stuff, I think, probably for the rest of the week. And we will see you tomorrow. Oh, no. What am I talking about? We're going to go to the better half of the program. You can IM the show at Majority FM. You can call us 646-257-3920. When we come back, there's a question for you to answer. Is Lindsey Graham stealing... Oh, sorry about that. You shut that door, please.
I got it.
Thank you. Is Lindsey Graham?
I just opened again.
Michael. Is Lindsey Graham stealing talking points from me? I don't know.
I think he might listen to the show.
Better half of the program. It's possible. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back.